Another minute or two here. See, I was thinking about, like, how long back I've thought about, like, the topic on this one is geologic hazards and humanity, and I can remember as a little kid, my grandparents lived on a lake in Maine, and they had a little creek that ran down to it, and I was a master at creating huge earthen dams in that little creek. It was channelized and had these little rock sides, and I'd build up a 3 foot wide, 3 foot high pile of mud and back that up, and then I'd intentionally fail it and rush out of the lake. So I think I was meant to deal with geologic hazards for a very long time. So,
don't create them, though.
Yeah, that's exactly. You know, just find them and let people know. So that's the topic tonight, is geology hazards. My specialty is engineering geology. A lot of these topics are things that I spend time thinking about at work and outside of work. My background, I got my undergraduate degree in 1990, and then got a graduate degree in volcanology in 94. So that's a cue. One of those hazards is volcanoes. And I spent a lot of my career dealing with landslide and rock pile hazards, as well as karst, which is a limestone topography, and the hazards associated with that, and groundwater issues. So those are a lot of topics that I'm going to get into today. And I kind of named a few of them already. This is a classic photograph of St. Helens. I'll talk about St. Helens a little bit more. It's a really interesting eruption, obviously very destructive, but at the same time it's an ongoing scientific experiment. So it's an amazing location. So some common hazards, the big glamorous ones are earthquake hazards and landslides and rock falls. Volcanoes obviously get everybody's attention, because when they go really big. But we also spend a lot of money dealing with things like sinkholes, weak soils. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on weak soils. It's more of a geotechnical issue. But if you're trying to build a large building on really soft soil, you're going to have to do a lot to be able to make sure that it doesn't settle and cause damage. And groundwater issues, most of what I'm going to talk about today as far as groundwater goes is more impacts due to extraction of groundwater versus like groundwater contamination and impacts and cleanup of that kind of thing. That's a whole other topic. It's a little less of a hazard. It's more of a human hazard that we created and we're now trying to clean up. So I'm going to start with earthquake hazards. Some of the most common ones, some of these are a little bit intuitive. If you actually have a fault that ruptures the ground, if your house is or building on top of that, that's fairly catastrophic. We all feel the ground shaking if anybody's been in an earthquake. Liquefaction is essentially when you shake a granular soil that's saturated, and it essentially loses all of its shear strength. So all of a sudden, all the grains that are interlocked start to float, and then they actually can flow. A subset of that is lateral spread, where you get this liquefaction condition, and you have a free face somewhere. So the ground can just kind of take off. Wharfs are a common location where you have a lot of hazards with lateral spread. Tsunamis, the big waves that have caused a lot of damage in the last decade or so, and some of the large subduction earthquakes. Seshes are a little bit of a niche that's particular to lakes, but you can definitely have some pretty catastrophic events, because obviously we like to put our houses right on the side of the lake to get a view.
What was that slide?
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what I meant? I did it on a couple other ones. Let me see if I can go back. So this is in Japan. It is actually liquefaction caused damage. So the ground underneath this building lost all of its strength, and basically the building fell in on itself. So and the whole thing tipped over. Fault rupture It's a pretty dramatic feature, obviously, when it occurs. Roads or other types of linear infrastructure are particularly susceptible to damage. Pipelines are also a major problem. Most buildings are typically nowadays not built on an actual rupture zone, just for they're fairly easy to see, and we sort of know, okay, past says it's going to fail here, it'll probably do it again, let's not build here. A little bit more on liquefaction. Like I mentioned, basically you have sand or silt or even fine gravel, depending on how much shaking you do, and the shaking kind of breaks the interlocking nature of those sand grains, and they just start to float. And then they can start to flow. If you've got sand underneath like a clay, then the sand will often become pressurized, and it's going to start trying to find a way to get out. It loses its strength, so your building starts to fall in on itself. It's a pretty significant hazard that we spend a lot of time trying to identify and engineer around so that buildings can handle some sort of a damaging event. A sand boil is a real common. This is where the sand literally boils up and bubbles over because you had this confining layer on top of some sort of sand layer. Building tipping over, here's where you had enough of a liquefaction and essentially the car just settled right into the ground. So, obviously if you had a bridge that was just sitting on top of the ground and the soil underneath it liquefied, all of a sudden your bridge is going to take off on you. Lateral spreading, like I mentioned, is a common issue near places where you have, say, if you had a pond or a lake or a waterfront right here, and you have some sort of a sand and then some sort of weak clay on top of it, all of a sudden you can just ride right out on that weak sand or that sand that's lost of its shear strength, and you get essentially have a planar failure where the material just moves out. Here we've these particular sort of wharf structures have bowed out a bit, and they're actually probably kind of holding this together. The whole thing probably would have been lost if those weren't there. So spend a lot of time nowadays when you're looking at upgrades to wharfs or waterfront properties worrying about this kind of issue, because you can move tens of feet in a single event. These are all pictures from Japan. It was by far the most damaging part of that earthquake. Japan is one of the more well-prepared countries from the standpoint of earthquake hazards, addressing earthquakes, trying to be prepared for them. And the one that they under-predicted, because they never thought they'd have an earthquake this big, was tsunamis. And that's where most of the damage and fatalities occurred, was because that's a picture of the tsunami going right over the top of a wall that they had built and designed based on what they thought was the worst case scenario, and they were like 10 feet short. So, and obviously we just had tremendous destruction, loss of life, impacts to a nuclear reactor. So, tsunamis are a major hazard, certainly near waterfronts. In the coast of Oregon and Washington, we have warning systems and all sorts of programs trying to be ready to sort of, engage the public if a large earthquake occurred. Just in concept, you need some sort of displacement event that pushes the water up in the air, and then that wave essentially propagates to shore. You don't typically see it's not like a huge wall of water coming, really, not like the movies show it where you have something just massive coming in, but it's this slug of water and it just rises up and will overwhelm a coastline. If you have a different kind of fault, if your fault is just kind of slipping like the San Andreas where you're sort of moving along one direction or another, you don't typically generate a significant tsunami because you don't get this big bump where your ground will move up 5 or 10 meters all at once and basically push that water up, creating that event. So what do we do as a society? If you live in California, you have several requirements just simply from a site investigation standpoint. They have lots of published maps that you have to use, look at, and you may have to do, actually go out and take a look at the site, maybe dig some test pits and look for potential hazards. The building codes are adjusted every time they have a major event. After the Japan event, after the Colombia event, the Chile event, both of those precipitated changes to the building permits and building codes to try to address how would a building handle and survive an earthquake. Foundation design is a huge part of it. We do all kinds of crazy things to try to make sure that we don't lose our buildings in an earthquake. If you travel on the coast of Oregon, you're constantly reminded of when you're entering and exiting tsunami zones. So, you know, in the event of a tsunami, they have arrows pointing which way do you go in case you can still drive, but most likely if you can run. And that's probably one of the first things that they tell you to do is that immediately after the event, you need to get out and leave that area. Because in all likelihood, within, I think on the coast of Oregon, I think it's 20, 30 minutes that you have if that event was a rupture of the fault off the coast of Oregon. So, unstable slopes. There are a lot of different types of unstable slopes. It's a kind of a catch-all phrase. I'm going to talk about a couple of them that are common hazards that we address and deal with regularly. From a landslide standpoint, you can have what's often called deep-seated or landslides, which are typically ones that are, you know, tens of feet thick and have different types of sub-descriptions for them. Debris flows are also a very damaging type of landslide. They're typically thin, they're on steep slopes, but they can be extremely damaging. And then the topic that I spend a lot of time on is rockfall hazards. And those are, you know, not just for roadways, but any structure that's near a steep slope. If you go out in the woods, there's some huge boulders lying in the woods. Some of those might be reacted by glacier, but a bunch of them probably came off the cliffs of those. So, you know, even here in Holden. What's that?
I just didn't hear what you said. Probably came off what?
The cliffs behind us, off of Martin's Ridge. So, you know, depending on where you're located, rocks can go an exceptionally long ways. So, this is a particular picture. It doesn't show up on my screen, but this is actually down on Highway 35, headed to the coast from I-5 in Oregon. Remarkably, no one was injured in this event. So the road had actually been closed because of a rockfall incident. Everybody stopped right underneath the rock slope and got out of their car. And we were like walking around wondering what to do. And all of a sudden, the slope let loose and destroyed three or four different cars. So, oh, thank you. That's better. It's much better. So it can be pretty substantial. The guy at that truck was a lucky camper. Highways departments spend a lot of money dealing with landslides. Prior to working for the company I do now, I spent 5 years working for Oregon Department of Transportation, and my primary job was going across the state trying to identify and catalog for sort of a risk-based evaluation of landslides and rockfalls across the state. This is up on Highway 101, down sort of southwest part of the coast, and you know we're not even trying to fix it right now. We're just trying to move the road around. This is actually quite old. This is like probably 60s or so, but they're just detouring the highway because they've just got to wait until it stops moving and then probably throw
is
a bunch of dirt.
Is that between Gold Beach and Brookings?
Yep. Yes. Exactly. So pick your hazard in that stretch of road. This is the Powers Highway, which is a highway of two powers. It's a fairly rural road, but it's also fraught with slope hazards. This was a totally stable slope for years, and then a bit too much, and in the course of a couple of weeks, it went from a rural highway to a detour. Landslides can develop in areas where there weren't landslides previously. Highways are not the only buildings, structures, pipelines, power facilities. This is a project up in, actually over on Baker Lake, This is a reservoir just south of Mount Baker, southeast of Mount Baker. Power structure, there's a big arch dam upslope of this. Here's a powerhouse with powerhouse number one and powerhouse number two. And then in 1965, we got rid of powerhouse number one, and they operated just with that powerhouse for about 40 years. We actually just recently added a powerhouse to kind of get them back up to speed. But, you know, totally missed. And it was a huge landslide sitting up above this thing, and when it let loose, it essentially took that structure out. You can go and find lots of these examples for lots of different structures. So it's a major part of the hazards you deal with in steep slope terrain. Here's another great example down in Utah. Very large landslide that activated, became very active, and literally filled in a ravine. You can see here's the shoreline here. Flooded out the highway, backed up. They actually had to build a tunnel to drain the lake on this one. It is still the most expensive landslide mitigation ever made in the United States. So these things can be a serious issue for folks with linear infrastructure. So debris flows are rivers of flowing mud, rock, and debris. They can vary from fairly fluid, almost just water, to a jumble of rocks that you can't believe is actually flowing, but it is. There's enough water and material in it. This is kind of a classic look of it, where you have, in steep terrain, you'll have a little bedrock, you have a little hollow up here. That hollow gets a bunch of soil that sort of develops, it weathers, and you get a layer of soft soil. Often you have shallow bedrock there, and then you get a big rainstorm, which we have all the time in the Pacific Northwest, and all that material gets saturated, and it weighs so much that it just kind of collapses under its own weight. And it starts coming down these ravines and bulking up, and then when it comes out of the ravine, it'll spread out in kind of a lobate shape and spread over whatever happens to be in the way. They can be very rapid moving and extremely damaging. Here's a typical view of a mountainous terrain. You see, it'll just pick up whatever happens to be in the way. These things are really amazing. There are sites I've been to where these will come down and then the stream channel takes a bend, and they're moving so fast, it's like you know, a car racing center where it banks, you know, go up 100 feet up the slope as it comes up and then moves down the valley. So when they decide to go, they will take off. This is a terrible photograph, but I wanted to bring it in just to sort of demonstrate. This was down in Columbia in 1985. It was actually a Lahar flow that bulked up, became a debris flow, came down the valley and into this community. Extremely catastrophic event. 23,000 people were killed. Most of them were never found. They were just taken away. So it can be an extremely damaging event. California deals with these often. Yeah.
What's the difference between a Lahar and a...
A Lahar is typically a derived from a volcanic event. Sometimes it's just material failing in pure volcanic material, whereas a mud flow or a debris flow is more something that's initiated in mountainous terrain. So this is kind of a half breed between those two. Rock falls, most of my experience is with the highway department and various industries that build things near steep slopes. I thought I'd just bring this example in because it was a fun project I did recently. This is out near Riggins, Idaho, and it's a big slope. This is Highway 95 running along on, this is the Snake River down here. Highway 95, it's the north-south highway for Idaho, which isn't actually saying that much, but it's still it's a significant transit route. And last fall, this slope, it's about 250 feet high, failed up at the top and dropped enough rock to close the road down. And a bit of a close-up of it.
Jamie, why did it fail?
It failed, there have been some significant rainfall events, and there's a lot of structure in this rock. You can see these planes here, and then there's another set of planes that are kind of in the opposite direction. It failed basically on what we call a wedge failure. So you had a joint or a weak surface on one side, another one on another side, and it was kind of pointing out of the slope, and for whatever reason it managed to hang on for a long time, and then at some point, possibly because you got enough water in there, and water kind of weakens the state of decreases the stability of these blocks, and you know, maybe it was just one piece that started coming out, and that was the key piece that was holding the whole slope up, and it just ripped loose. We were looking primarily, we were mapping, had lots of fun up there. We actually had to rappel down this slope to get access to this, and there's a block that is just pretty much at the top of this picture here that's probably a 30 foot by 30 foot by 30 foot block, so maybe half this room, that was hanging up on top, and that was kind of a, you know, a critical loose block that we managed to, we actually blasted that off, so similar to what they're going to do down in the creek, but 200 feet above the river. And I have a great video of that, and if anybody wants to see it later, we'll dig it up. I couldn't make it work on the computer when I was trying to do the presentation. So how do we deal with unstable slopes as a society? Building codes are a big part of it. As far as, you know, on the coast of Oregon, Tillamook County requires sort of a geohazards assessment of any property before you have a building permit. Basically, they've had so many problems with buildings and coastal community houses being built and then taken off to the ocean that they just require it right out of sight. It's required for a lot of projects. If you're looking to build a large infrastructure project, part of the permitting project is a specific geohazard or unstable slope stability study. So you'll hire geologists, engineers to essentially go out and identify the hazards. Hazard mapping at both a state and federal level. A lot of states have landslide maps or landslide hazard maps that are based on steepness of slope. And I'll talk a little bit more about hazard prioritization as a management tool here in just a sec for large utilities or transportation departments that have a lot of problems. Here's an example of a map that you might make. This is actually a project that I was involved with last year where there's an existing water conveyance line, a little red line there. This is in Washington, and it's been there for like 100 years. And it's an open flume that has a little train that rides on top of it. And the train still works. And they were looking at what are the risks associated with maintaining this. And one of the biggest risks was the fact that 2 miles of that line was on a huge landslide. You can see this is the back scarp of the slide here where the slope is really steep, the contours are really close. And then if you look at these are all contour lines, and you can see how irregular they are, and they're not a typical drainage pattern. That's just, the slide has been moving along and most likely pushed the river over to the other side of the valley just through its failure and movement.
Where is this?
It's up west of Mount Rainier, so off of the Puyallup River system, which is incised deeply into a canyon in that area. So I'm not going to talk a whole lot about this. This is more mostly a cue for me. Several state transportation systems manage their hazards from a slopes standpoint using sort of a rating system. And you look at a variety of factors. This is ODOT's system. They look at the type of hazard. Is it a low, high, medium, or high hazard as far as like what's the potential impact? What is the roadway impact? What's it actually going to do? What's the maintenance on it? You know, this is a dollar thing. You know, does maintenance go out and kick a rock off the road once a year? Or do they spend like $100,000 putting new pavement and building the road back up all the time? This is a political piece right here. How many cars go by in a day? So if this is a rock that runs on the road out in a rural eastern Oregon or Washington highway, they just probably the rancher's gonna stop and pick it and take it off the road. But if a rock falls on the road in Portland, it's front page news. So there's a rating that goes into that. You gotta consider those sorts of things. Accident history is a big one. Essentially the top score is a fatality, and that does happen. So if that site has a history of that, then it's gonna score really high. You could argue, well, is there a good chance that the rock's gonna fall off the slope and go through the windshield twice? But you can't ignore that risk. And then of course, is it an interstate or is it a district highway? So those all get summed up and we create a hazard score that basically allows you to rank the hazards of either the landslide or the rock fall. And then you have this great list, and here's number one, and of course number one costs $20 million to fix, so number one sits there for a long time. But it's used as a way to at least try to identify and prioritize hazards and do something about them, ideally. That, of course, requires money. Okay, so moving away from landslides, but not completely, because there are lots of slope hazards with volcanoes, like Lahar's issues. So common hazards and volcanic or volcano terrain, lava flows, like I showed earlier, Lahars that are sometimes associated with rainfall on volcanoes. You can have landslide hazards. Pyroclastic flows are typically where you have some sort of collapse or failure on the volcano. It's a steep slope, it entrains a lot of air, and you really have a particle debris flow that comes down the mountain at 60 miles an hour. Airfall, if we have a big eruption that actually creates a column of particulate into the air, and that takes off down and can cover hundreds of thousands of miles with fine ash, and that can be an extremely disruptive. It's disruptive to airlines, human health, vehicles. So there's a lot of issues that can come into play. Mentioned the lava. If it happens to be your backyard, that's about it. There have been instances where they've tried to deflect these, and they usually aren't very successful. Putting a barricade isn't very effective. There have been instances where they've tried to dig out like a trench, but usually you don't have a whole lot of time to be thinking about this. So these kind of go where they want to go. This is actually a pyroclastic flow. You can just see, sort of envision, here's the top of the volcano, and the whole slope is just flying down the hill. They basically had a lava flow that collapsed, and someone was lucky enough to be in a helicopter or an airplane right when that event happened, and they took a series of photographs of that. So it was really an extraordinary. Usually we just see the aftermath of something like that and come back and it's just laid flat. So a little bit on St. Helens. This had, they lost about 1,300 feet of mountain off the top in a huge landslide. So it wasn't like it just blew its stack. The whole thing fell off. And they'd been monitoring this. There had been lava that sort of intruded into the mountain to a relatively shallow depth, and it's causing the mountain to inflate. And it inflated, and there's enough cracking and deformation that literally the north side of the mountain slumped off and failed. And it created a tremendous... So essentially, think of this as like if your little brother or sister shakes the can of pop and then gives it to you, and you don't know it, you just open it up and it just goes in your face. Well, that's kind of what happened here. Lava has a lot of gas that's dissolved into it under pressure. And if you take that pressure away, it instantly volatilizes. And so you can create a tremendous amount, a tremendous blast. The lateral blast off St. Helens was essentially equivalent to 1,000 Hiroshima nuclear blasts. And you can see essentially what it did. It just, it's an old growth tree that was just blown away. And obviously everything else, including I think 54 people, perished in that event. It had lots of other impacts. This is a view from Eastern Oregon of the ash cloud that that basically turned day into night in May of 1980. Here's a distribution of ash. You know, trace, you know, a centimeter or two, spread all the way to the Midwest. Here's somebody trying to deal with it in their vehicle. The ash is extremely destructive to engines. Obviously, you're pulling air in. You pulled all that ash in, and it'll just eat your engines up. A lot of the loggers that were doing a lot of the timber salvage afterwards in the blast zone and then that periphery were swapping out chainsaws on like a weekly basis, and the engines were just wrecked. You know, respiratory is obviously trying to do what he can to deal with that. You know, this event probably, you know, air traffic was routed around it since it's such an obvious one. Our sensitivity to air traffic is much higher now due to the, you know, some recent events of engines conking out and such like that. But, you know, and so here's a couple other examples. Here's St. Helens. Here's a couple other volcano eruptions, Long Valley caldera. And a caldera is essentially where you have the classic caldera concept is where you have a shallow body of lava and it starts to erupt. And you have enough material that erupts that you have a volume loss. And so the area above that collapses. And so the whole thing falls in itself. And often you get a very large vertical eruption following that collapse. So here's a couple of distributions from other eruptions that have occurred historically in the past. So remember Long Valley and Yellowstone. These bubbles, this actually wasn't the one I was looking for. They have this really cool one that's got little smokestacks coming out of the volcanoes, but I couldn't find that one. Up here in the corner is Mount St. Helens. So we all thought that was a huge event. A quarter of a cubic kilometer of material. Here's Yellowstone, and there's 1,000 cubic kilometers. And, you know, Long Valley, 580. You know, so just to understand, like, how big these things can be, St. Helens was a blip on the radar screen. You know, there's Pinatubo over there, 5 cubic kilometers of material erupted. You know, if we had one of these larger events, it would certainly be, you know, climate-changing events from a long-duration standpoint. That probably means better ski seasons for a long time. So for some of us, that wouldn't necessarily be all bad, but if you happen to be anywhere near these, that would not be ideal. This is in eastern, actually even in western Oregon, Cortland area, we have problems with these. This is a lava tube. In Bend, it's a huge issue. They have lava tubes all over the place. And you can have even a shallow foundation that's enough weight to cause the lava tube to collapse. So, and they're very difficult to detect without drilling a bunch of holes, which is not cheap. So trying to sort of evaluate where you have those hazards and where you're not likely to. We had a project over there, St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland. They ran into a lava tube, and sort of a common way of handling this is you just start pumping cement grout in there, trying to fill it up. And they pumped thousands of cubic yards of cement into this lava tube, and it never stopped taking grout, and so they finally gave up. And they thickened the grout up and kind of fixed the local problem, but who knows where that was going. So it's not quite as flashy as a Plinian eruption, but it's a significant issue for those of us that are trying to build a house in lava terrain area. What do? There's lots of different ways to monitor for hazards. Looking at remote sensing, I'll talk a little bit about that in a sec. Seismicity. A lot of times, prior to volcanic eruptions, there's seismicity. As lava moves up through the rock, it actually fractures the rock, and that's recorded in sort of small earth tremors. Bulging, they had, I can't remember how many tilt meters that they had on St. Helens. And so as it bulged, they actually could measure, they knew that the north side was bulging more than anywhere else. Just what do you do about it? So, and what they did was they evacuated and they minimized fatalities as much as they could. Geophysical measurements, hydrology, gas is often a good indicator. The gas mixture and combinations and frequency and intensities change as a lava is getting close to the surface and maybe getting ready to erupt. This is an example, this is the Three Sisters Wilderness. If anybody's been skiing on Mount Bachelor or climbed some of the Sisters in the Three Sisters Wilderness, this is, Bend is just off to the east here. Back in the early 2000s, they were using satellite radar imaging technology. And basically what they do is they look for differences. So they fly an area and then they fly it again, and they're up there now flying away and measuring these, and it's a fairly continuous process of just trying to map the Earth's surface and looking for significant changes. And lo and behold, the west side of South Sister started to bulge. And it was bulging on their rate of, you know, an inch or two a year, which doesn't seem very exciting, but that's certainly a lot more than anywhere else was bulging. And it got a lot of press, and it's kind of calmed down. So who knows, maybe there was just a little bit of an intrusion and it'll never go anywhere. Or maybe it's just the start of a new plumbing system that will eventually create a new cinder cone or a lava volcano off to the west there. Cinder cones are typically single-time eruption events where the lava comes out, blows a bunch of cinders in the air, and then you get a few lava flows. It doesn't often repeat itself a whole lot.
So is this LIDAR imaging?
No, this is actually, it's similar, it's remote imaging where you're using, instead of light, it's using radar, and you know how fast it travels, and you know where the satellite is, so you can get a surface. It's just not as accurate as LIDAR, but it's the exact same concept, essentially. I can talk for hours on LIDAR, so that's a dangerous topic. Exactly. Sinkholes. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we don't really think about this a whole lot because we have lots of volcanoes and cool things like that. But in a lot of other parts of the country, there's a lot of limestone. And when you start flowing limestone, water through limestone, especially if it's meteoric water that's a little more acidic than limestone likes to see, you start dissolving the limestone away and you're creating all sorts of cavities, underground streams and rivers and channels. At the ground surface, you can create this amazing complex topography called karst topography. The primary issue that we worry about from a geohazard standpoint is collapsing features, so sinkholes, essentially. And here's a little bit of a better idea of it. You know, you've got fractures in the aquifer, this limestone aquifer. We're, of course, messing with it all the time because we like to pump water, or we got settling ponds from our wastewater treatment facility. And so we're always mixing this in on top of things. And so sometimes we're actually accelerating the erosive process of the water flowing through, or changing the rate of flow, which can also cause rapid dissolution of the limestone. And, you know, in this case, they're sort of saying, well, if you have a layer of soil on top, maybe you had a cave and it just decided to collapse. Other times you actually have accelerated erosion and then collapse of the rock. And it's obviously extremely disruptive. You know, these can pop up all over the place if you're on top of bedrock. What do you do? Hazard maps are a really good way of at least informing people of the risk of that. The reality is that pretty much if you have a significant structure, you should probably go out and do some exploration. You should go out and hire one of the guys that are over on the other side of the river and have them drill a hole down in the ground and find out if there's a big cavity. And it's pretty obvious because you'd be drilling along and all of a sudden all your equipment just drops 10 feet or 40 feet or 200 feet, and you know where you're at with that. I put this one in. I thought this was really cool. It's actually not a limestone sinkhole. This is down in Guatemala, and the whole city is underlain by several hundred feet of pumice that filled in this valley. And maybe it was a leaking pipe or some other infrastructure that basically, piped all that pumice out and created this huge hole. But I thought it was a cool picture, so I put it in. So groundwater extracts, substance associated with groundwater extraction is kind of the groundwater topic I wanted to just touch on tonight. And this has happened in a lot of places. There's a lot of cities and areas around the world where we are having a significant impact because of our water needs and our water demands. We go out and we stick wells in because we need to irrigate. It's just kind of what this is showing. A lot of times we need water for people to drink. And if we're in an arid environment, we don't have a nice, great river to draw from. So we go and turn wells on. And what happens is, at one time, groundwater sort of was at a certain level, and then you start pulling the water out, and there's not enough water going back in, so the water level starts to drop. If you have an area where you have like clay or silty material, once you take the water out of that, the clay will actually start to consolidate and settle. And so at the ground surface, the ground literally starts to drop. This is sort of a schematic of the San Joaquin Valley. And back in the 50s through the 70s, they were doing, most of their water was obtained through groundwater extraction. They had a huge system of wells. And by the early 1970s, they had up to 25 feet of settlement of the ground surface. Now, it's pretty broad, so your house would probably be fine. But your canal was going to start flowing in the wrong direction. And if your pipeline, your gas pipeline was in there, that could also be a big problem because your pipe may not be stretching enough to handle that. So they actually changed, they had to go in and change how they handled groundwater, their water management system. In California, that turns out to be that they go and they grab water from somewhere else and bring it in, not that they change how they do their practices. But they did actually stop the groundwater, the settlement of the ground. So they solved one problem, maybe created another one. Mexico City is, their primary water source is the aquifer underneath it. And right now, and this is just sort of an intensity map showing like where it's settling the most and where it's settling the least. I don't know Mexico City that well, so I'm not gonna go very deep into where things are at. But if an airport is settling, that's generally bad news. They're withdrawing, they're lowering their groundwater table now approximately 3 feet a year. And the ground surface in the worst case areas is settling 3 inches a year. So it's a fairly non-sustainable path. But they're also in a very arid area, and they have had tremendous population growth, and that's continuing today. So they're in a really tough spot. You know, even, and they are, you know, threatening all kinds of implications if you use too much water, and people are just not reacting to that. So what do you do? You know, in the case of settlement, you basically have to stop lowering the water table. And even if you do that, it's still going to continue, because if there's a zone that was previously saturated, that fine-grained material is going to continue to kind of consolidate over time, but it will slowly stop. Conservation, obviously, seems like an obvious thing, but it can be very hard to implement. One of the ways you implement it is you make it really expensive. And you know, we're seeing this in Portland, where we're trying to manage our water system and seeing significant price changes. You can turn to surface water sources, but that obviously has downsides to, well, what happens to the fish down the way. In Southern Oregon, Klamath Falls area, surface water sources are a huge debate right now because of water rights issues. And you can just restrict people outright as to how much water they can have. This was a picture actually of a job site where we drilled drilled a hole straight into a mountainside, and we intercepted the groundwater, and we had like 50 GPM coming out of the pipe, which was actually a very useful piece of information for us. Anyway, that was my spiel. I put this up here. I was with a friend a couple years ago up in Winthrop, and we got this humongous load of wood for like $100. And it was in this big old 1956 Ford, and I drove it like 30 miles, and you know, the steering wheel can turn about 90 degrees just straight. And so anyway, I thought that was an entertaining slide right now. So questions, thoughts on hazards and people's experience of how they've managed a hazard, or seen a hazard managed in their world.
There's an incident outside of West Yellowstone, adjacent to the Madison River. In the 50s, there was an individual who was convinced there was going to be a nuclear attack on the United States, and he built this beautiful rock house on the mountainside just back from the valley of near Hepken. And a massive earthquake split his house in half. He was right on the fault.
Beautiful view, now he's got two houses. Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was a very drastic slide because there were 27 campers in the campground that were buried.
Yeah.
Is that just an urban legend that there's a danger in California falling into the ocean?
You know, it's probably an urban legend for our lifespan, but everything west of San Andreas is going to be up in Oregon at some point. So,
as the effect of water rising too, is that going to make any difference?
Probably not on the San Andreas. Groundwater extraction has been hypothesized to be be part of a cause for earthquakes activity. But I don't think anyone's been able to be particularly definitive about that. So fracking, maybe there might be a little bit more of an argument there for causing that damage. Yeah.
Yeah, can you talk about the link between the
I'm not an expert at that, but I think that, you are, my take on it is that you are changing the pressure conditions at depth, because you basically are, you're fracturing the rock and then withdrawing and essentially creating a pressure conduit to the surface. That fracturing of the rock may weaken rock adjacent to, say, an old fault that may be stuck on something. So you've got a fault and your rock is kind of caught up on it, and then you break the rock up on one side of that, it's going to have a better chance of moving. So in the right location at the right spot, seems to me like it's certainly not inconceivable. Is it going to be a standard occurrence every time someone goes up and does a fracking program? That, it's probably extrapolating, especially it depends a bit on like what kind of tectonic area you're in. If you're in an area that's not very tectonically active, the chances of causing faulting or an earthquake are probably lower than they are if they're in even an old, like even the Appalachians, there's probably a higher chance there than if you're fracking in Kansas. So, super. All right. Well, if anybody has other questions, and if anybody wants to see the rock wall thing, I can go ahead and dig that up. That was nice.
Would you see liquefaction as being a thing?